Golden Spiral Media presents The Blacklist Exposed.
Happy New Year, one and all, and welcome to the continuation of Season 8 of the award-winning The Blacklist Exposed podcast. I'm Agent Troy Heinrichs.
And I am Agent Aaron Peterson, and we have a treat for you. You're going to be treated to one of, I think, our best interviews, personally. But we're not there yet. Show notes and other intel for this episode of The Blacklist Exposed can be found at theblacklistexposed.com.
Well, 2 months ago, we saw Raymond Reddington and Liz Keene's relationship fall apart with the killing of the woman claiming to be Katerina Rostova. I still don't think we've settled it in 2 months.
We didn't get an ID check, no. I don't think.
A lot of chatter online, but nothing definitive. Since that 2 months has passed, I think the entire world has fallen apart. We had holiday traditions done a little bit differently. We've got the raging, now mutating pandemic still rocking the world. And here in the States, specifically in the last 2 months, a very volatile election season. Thankfully, we can focus on something positive, finally, now, as The Blacklist returns January 22nd at 8 Eastern Pacific, 7 Central on NBC. And we're coupling that this week with the fact that here in the States this weekend, the airing of this podcast is literally the one day that we celebrate and honor the birth, life, and dreams of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. as we continue to look for a way to make his dreams a reality by coming together as one people under God. So we thought, why not talk to a man who is a literal symbol for good in the world, a man who listens and understands and is passionate not only about the arts, but his community, his friends, and his family. We're pleased this week to bring you our discussion with Director Cooper himself, Mr. Harry Lennox.
Yeah, and I want you guys to know it's a very deep, thought-provoking, very interesting interview. Actually, probably a lot. Harry goes a lot deeper than I thought he was going to, and I had a great time. I just think he's a wonderful man in general and a wonderful person to talk to.
Yeah, he's very thoughtful, and you're probably going to want to make sure you grab some popcorn, grab a drink, because this is going to be one of our longer interviews that we've had on the show.
Settle in. Yep, settle in.
Because it's a good conversation and a really good, I think it's the conversation we all need to have right now in what we're dealing with in the world.
Ah, look at this guy over here with his deepness. Deep Thoughts by Troy Heinrichs.
My middle name's Jack.
and Zack Snyder stuff. So there's some really cool Zack Snyder conversation that I think people are going to love.
That's right. You're going to hear it here first. Plus, Harry talks about all the fun stuff about his role as Cooper and what we can expect to see from Cooper when season 8 continues just in a few days. So I think we should just get on into it, Aaron, shall we not?
I think we probably should have shut up a long time ago. Here you go. Here's Harry Lennox.
He's been on the big screen in movies such as The Matrix Reloaded and Revolutions, Man of Steel, Batman vs. Superman, and Chi-Raq. Plus, he's also on the small screen too in series such as 24, Emily Owens, MD, Billions, and playing your favorite role of director Harold Cooper in The Blacklist. But before we get started, Harry, my dear friend and co-host, Mr. Aaron Peterson, I think he's fallen asleep for a little while when it comes to the greatness that is the character of Boyd Langton in Joss Whedon's Dollhouse. Can you help me convince this man to finally watch Dollhouse? Because we've been on this thing for like 7 years since The Blacklist started, and he will not give in.
I've watched part of it.
Yeah, well, that's about how much I watch too. In all honesty, I didn't see it a whole bunch. Just we weren't around all that long, and what little I did see of it, I enjoyed. You know, I thought it was an interesting idea. I don't like to watch my work generally, just because I get self-conscious about what I'm doing, you know, coming up later. But I just, you know, I think the whole idea was sort of a interesting exploration into where things seem to be going now, which is programmable people. You know, I think that that's inevitable at this point. And I think one day, probably around the time that Aaron decides that he's going to watch the show, it'll be a fait accompli. It'll be a very interesting time.
I'll be fully assimilated.
That's right.
It's weird because we thought about programming digitally people to get them to do certain things. And now you just think about social media and the news and all of that stuff and how it's attacking and putting us, that we are actually getting programmed in a certain way. It's very fascinating.
It is. You know, I'm a big, well, I've recently discovered this guy, so to speak. You guys probably knew about him already, but Marshall McLuhan, the media theorist out of Toronto, I think maybe the University of Toronto. Anyway, he was always saying, he said many very smart things, which were later appropriated. I think that even something like tune in, turn on, drop out was kind of an appropriation of his, from Timothy Leary, I think, a global village. But one of the things that he talked about was that the medium is the message. And that is that the technology itself, such as it is in this new world that we're in, and even at the time when it was developing in the 50s when TV and that, is that in itself it contains the message and it directs as much as is directed by the people who consume it. So I think that that's coming to be. And much of what he said is
great. Yeah. That terrifies me, is what that does.
He also said a very funny thing, which I like. I used it yesterday. We don't know who discovered water, but we're sure it wasn't a fish.
I like that. I like that a lot.
I do like that.
That's good.
You know, it's funny. We've got, obviously, we got questions and whatnot, but I was going through your history, and I didn't realize, like, one thing I realized that I've forgotten, and one thing that I didn't even realize, I really like The Package as a movie. I think that's a really good movie with Gene Hackman. I didn't remember you being in it. I haven't seen it in a lot of years.
Yeah.
Which was, well, it was great. I'm like, oh, he was in that. And then I'm going through and I'm like, I remember you in the Perry Mason movie. I remember that.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Because
that was a really exciting. I'm like, he was a prosecutor, right? You were the prosecutor, if
can
I remember.
You imagine?
Right.
Yes, I was. I played, I think the, was I maybe an assistant DA or something like that at the time. I can't remember the character's name because we shot that in 1990, right? Yeah. After I finished on The Five Heartbeats. I just wrapped. It was my first job after The Five Heartbeats. It must have been like May of 1990. Mm-hmm. And I was in Denver, Colorado, or Colorado Springs, actually. And then to be opposite the great Raymond Burr, another Canadian, by the way, Barbara Hale, who's a wonderful, wonderful actress, who was the mother, by the way, of William Catt.
Yep.
Yep. You know, so. I knew that. Yeah, which is, you know, a legend and a beautiful woman, very kind. I worked with Robert Culp was on that episode. Kevin Teague was on that episode. The great Robert Vaughn was on that. So, like, I was surrounded by guys that I've been watching on TV shows.
Your whole life.
For a long time. It was really great.
Yeah, I remember that because I'm a huge, and Troy knows this, I'm a huge Perry Mason fan. Okay. And I remember that was, I was looking, actually looking back because I was trying to find the title of it. So I was looking back through your history. I'm like, oh, and then that's where I saw The Package because it was right below that.
Give us the title, Aaron.
Well, no, I didn't write it down because I was just looking for me. But it was, hang on.
It's called The Case of the Defiant Daughter.
Defiant Daughter. Yep. Defiant Daughter.
I'm living that right now. I don't know what you guys are talking about.
Very cool.
That's funny. And I'm going to ask you about Five Heartbeats. That's actually on here, but I'll come back to that.
Okay.
I want to know, because you've been acting for years. You've been, I mean, decades, like you just said, 1990, before that.
If that's what you call acting.
I remembered it. I consider it memorable. So what made you want to become an actor or an artist? To begin with, was there like a specific moment for you where it just hit you and you said, that's what I want to do the rest of my life?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think the first, my first spark of inspiration, so to speak, was looking at my brother, Larry. He's no longer with us, but he had a good time while he was here. I'll tell you that. But
that's all you can ask for.
That's all you can ask for. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, we can get into those kinds of philosophical things a bit later if you like, but yeah, I think it is all you can ask for. And people, if you think about somebody like Alexander the Great or even Julius Caesar, they didn't live, or Jesus Christ, they didn't live long lives, but very impactful ones. Of course, Dr. King, Malcolm X, all of them, they died before the age of 40. But in any case, he was 50, by the way. But I saw him in a performance. I was in second grade and he was in eighth grade. At St. Bride Elementary School on the south side of Chicago. And he was playing a street tough on the corner, like hustling somebody for money, and somebody hit him in the head with what I took to be a baton of some sort. It was actually a piece of rolled up paper. And I was so convinced of that, of the reality, even though it was absurd, really. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you're a kid, you sort of think of everything as real. You know, this is before the Santa Claus mystery was solved for me and so forth. But that said, now that I'm a detective on TV, I would have figured that one out in a minute. But
we hope.
I saw him, and I was completely convinced that he was hurt. And so a few minutes, 5 minutes later, you know, they were milling about in what you can only describe as the backstage area, which is, you know, a little school auditorium stage thingy. And he was fine. And so I said, "Hey, man, are you hurt?" And he was like, "No, man, we were just acting." And so I was like, "Oh, man, okay, well, I could do that. I could do that. Play make-believe and convince people that something that wasn't true was true." And so I think I know that that was the first time that I was intrigued by the idea. And then a few years later, there was a circumstance in a church. I went to a Catholic school. I studied to be a priest, by the way. So I went to a Catholic school all of my life. But before I got to the seminary, there was an occasion, I might have been in sixth grade, where it was like an ensemble piece that was going to be part of a liturgy where the sixth graders were, you know, enacting something. And somebody dropped their line. And I don't think, and I knew that they weren't going to recover the line that they dropped. I knew that there was, you know, there would have been noticeable pause if it had gone on like that. Mm-hmm. So I knew the line. And so I recited it. I set it out. And without a hitch, it went off. And then, like, later, the nuns and stuff started giving me roles. So, like, we started doing a spring musical at that point from the sixth grade. And in the eighth grade, I was chosen to play Thomas Edison in a little musical called The Electric Sunshine Man. And they, and such was the case at the time where they brought up some kids from a suburb, a western suburb of Chicago, a bunch of white Catholic kids. This is an all-black school I was in mostly by that point. And the kids loved the show, and we got a chance to talk with them after we had, like, lunch, you know, one of those assembly lunch things afterward. And one of them told me the greatest compliment that I could hear, which is, he said, "You know, you remind me of Clifton Davis."
Oh.
And if you guys don't know who Clifton Davis, I'm sure you
do. I do.
But he was my favorite actor at the time because he was on a show called That's My Mama. I think that was That's My Mama or something like that. Anyway, something like the one of the 70s shows, and I loved it, and it was my favorite show. And he was my favorite guy on it. I thought he was so handsome. And then later I got to meet him in real life, and he's the nicest person. He is a great songwriter, by the way. He wrote the song "Never Can Say Goodbye." By the
way, I didn't know that.
Yeah, he wrote that. He wrote that. Just got finished playing the genie in Aladdin on Broadway. He did it very many times, 1,000 times or something. So anyway, that was really the interest. Although at that time I didn't intend to pursue it as a career, I thought I was going to be a priest. So I went on to the seminary. And then later, you know, like in the second year, after being a bust at baseball, I decided that since I was going to be a pro player slash priest, I saw a bunch of pretty girls that were coming up to this all-boy seminary. Mm-hmm. And I was like, "What are they doing here?" And they were auditioning for the spring musical. And my sophomore year, I decided to do it. And by the time I was a senior, you know, there were professionals who would come up and see our shows from time to time, and they thought that I had potential to be a pro. One of them thought I was already a pro and that they had brought me in to sort of be a ringer in this high school production. So when I heard that, I was like, "Man, I'm going to go for it. But I'm not going to be a baseball player. They don't have pretty girls for priests, at least not officially. So this is the way to do it." So it was really a process, but it started with my brother.
That's a pretty fantastic story. And yeah. That's kind of cool because you were on Madam Secretary, right? With Clifton Davis, wasn't that right?
No, I never did an episode of Madam Secretary. I know he was on the show.
I thought you were on it too. I don't know why I thought you were on it too.
No, I'd have been happy to do it.
But I didn't watch it. I didn't watch it. I just know he was on it, and I thought I could have swore I thought you were on it too. So that's
my mistake. You're thinking about Aaron. You're thinking about Commander in Chief, where I played the chief of staff to
yes
female.
Yeah, yeah, maybe I'm just getting them confused. Yeah. Getting confused.
Easy to do.
Maybe you have more a few too many credits. How about that?
That could be. It could be not enough as far as I'm concerned.
Not enough. You've got like 129, I think I saw something like.
Oh, wow. Well, that yeah. pales in comparison to the great Eric Roberts, who's got 500 or something.
Right? Oh, my Lord. Yeah. Yeah. His credits are insane.
Yeah. Yeah.
So from the 80s to now, I mean, what has changed most for you as an actor, both in terms of like how your process works, because obviously you kind of came onto it more as you discovered your talent. So I don't know if you changed how you act as you went or not, as well as the industry itself, like as you've grown through it.
Well, you know, in the 80s, just thinking about, you know, the training I was in, I got to Northwestern in 82. I left in 86. I was doing professional work from 84. Yeah, something like that, the summer of 84. And, I would say at that time I was very much a method actor, you know, and sort of dedicated to the idea of living a life in the theater. And mm-hmm. somehow I had the idea that it was a more pure, noble medium. And, you know, I've since changed that opinion, particularly since there's no work in the live theater at this moment. So, you know, conveniently enough. As a method actor, you know, I was very sort of intense and tortured and very wanting to. I was actually really imitating actors that I like, and that mm-hmm. was. And I recommend that, but at the time, I would never have admitted to it. But yeah, I was.
So you didn't feel like you were being you. You felt like you were duplicating what you admired, essentially.
Yes, and I studied, you know, a lot. Mm-hmm. Assiduously, I would say. This is before the age of VCRs, you know, at least we didn't have one. So I would stay up late at night. I would get a TV guide and I would circle all the movies that had actors in it that I wanted to study their work. And I would stay up 3-4 o'clock in the morning on the weekends, definitely just looking at the stuff from Olivier or from Burton or from Ralph Richardson. If I knew that Peter Ustinov was going to be in, you know, I would just look at these people. Sidney Poitier, I discovered some people, but I was reading, I worked in a library at Northwestern. And so I would look up all of the biographies of the actors and then they would reference other actors. And so, you know, it was really a great time of consuming volumes and volumes of acting methodologies and acting careers. And so I really tried to, I emulated and imitated much of what I was consuming. And I'm glad I did it because it has since given me sort of a freedom to examine other forms. So curiously, in the very early part of my career, I would say to about the age of 30, you know, I was pretty much a dedicated method actor. And that is the Stanislavski method as understood and properly taught by Stanislavski himself and some of his dedicated acolytes. Some people sort of bastardized what it was. I would even say, well, you know, much of the American New York style, the stuff that that Pacino and De Niro were doing is a kind of form of the Stanislavski method and is called that. But it really isn't. It's like really a Lee Strasberg methodology, which is great, but not what I came to know as method acting. Is taught by Alvina Krauss, who was a legendary teacher who'd been in Northwestern, taught a lot of those famous people, Patricia Neal and Charlton Heston, and for whatever that's worth, whatever you think of that.
damn dirty apes.
Hey, listen, she thought that he was iconic, and I learned a lot from him. And people like John Wayne, who's their politics I didn't have much use for, but mm-hmm. in terms of being sizable men with some size on them, tall.
Gravitas.
Gravitas. But they moved through space with a great amount of grace. And so I always liked that. My favorite of those guys, by the way, is the great Burt Lancaster, who just moved like a ballet dancer because he was an acrobat, you know. So I would study these people, and I would copy them as much as I could. And then through that, I kind of found, rather than sort of being inside out, you know, kind of finding the emotional reality and the walk, which is something that Monty Clift used to do. He would always, he said he found the walk of the character first. Watching people like Paul Newman and how he walked and moved. But I was trying to generate all of these motivations, if you will, internally. And so I finally hit on a method, really, which is a little bit more British, which I guess, which is sort of working outside in, creating the trappings of the character, how they dress, how they look, how they sound, finding the song of the character that I wanted to play, and then using that to sort of sift in and really protecting myself emotionally and psychologically as an actor. So really thinking of it more as, instead of being a shaman or a mystic, of thinking of myself as the magician, and sort of giving the illusion of an internal motivating factor, but learning how to do external things like listening and learning to listen. I didn't study Meisner, but that's really the sort of key to that method, which is active listening and repeating and, you know, these kinds of things when you're trying to find the core of the reality. So I'm not a Meisner actor as such. I'm not a method actor really as such anymore, but it's really whatever is effective given the style of performance. And I think that too few people in this industry think about style anymore. You know what I mean? Like if you think about the great style of Cary Grant, or even...
Oh, I love Cary Grant.
He's great.
I do. Yeah.
Discovered by Mae West, who had her own style, and who these actors like Helen Hayes and Franchot Tone, these people who bought something with them that was consistent from whatever character they find. Of course, the greats like Bette Davis and
Jimmy Stewart, Edward
Tracy.
Jimmy Stewart.
Yeah, these guys, you know, and those people in that era, in that golden age of film, had, I think, a greatly missing element, which is style. I see very little of it anymore, if any, frankly. I see behavior.
Yeah.
You know.
A lot of behavior.
Yeah. But somebody, you know, and of those behaviorists working today, so to say, and I don't mean that, you know, there's nothing wrong with behavior, but I love the work that Joaquin Phoenix is
doing,
man.
He transforms.
He's something. So, you know, I like looking at, there's a lot of actors who I admire, but he's probably right now my apex.
Do you feel the coasts are different between New York and California? Like the New York style actor versus a Hollywood style actor?
There used to be, you know what I mean? Like in the old days when people like, Glenn Ford, Hollywood guy, certain actors, you know, who came up in that system, be it, you know, Lana Turner, who kind of grew up out there and went to school with Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney and those guys who came up in that system, who learned really on screen. And weren't sort of based or steeped in the kind of theatrical presentationalism thing, but had a different kind of approach. I think there was more of a distinction between West and East Coast, but I don't think so anymore. Not really. To the extent that you are a stage actor and you're trained there, I think that there's sometimes a difference in approach, style, temperament, in that way, but not so much regionally.
Well, there's definitely styles difference between television and film and the movies. You've done both. So do you prefer the steady TV work now, or do you like the big bombastic, go on location, travel around the world kind of movie side of the business, or both equally?
I think really both equally. You know, there's something about the process of film. You have a little bit more time. It's more like a middle distance race as opposed to the long haul of TV where you're actually really doing several movies or several movie length things, you know. With film, I think that, you know, it's just the day is a little more relaxed. You don't have to really try to meet the commitment of page counts a day as much. It's a little more process oriented in a way, whereas, you know, TV is more product oriented, but that's a different discipline. And I think it requires a different set of muscles in many ways. But both, all of them are challenging. Theater, film and TV, while they, you know, they're different, you know, like running a middle distance race, a relay race, or, you know, a dash, we used to call the dash. I think are all different. They require, and they have different benefits and different, what's the word? Different, obstacles for them, but figuring those out, you know, I have a lot of fun doing that. And I really, as I said, I like to do that from the outside in, almost an intellectual investigative, you know, process where you shortcut in many ways the amount of time that you would have to prepare for a project, the amount of time that you would be in rehearsal for a show, where you're actually really digging deep and doing the same material day after day, but finding different things, you know, shortcuts almost, so to speak, but then also discovering rabbit holes that you then have to explore. So I like them all. The stability of knowing you're going to be having a job next week, next month is awesome. And it gives you, it relaxes you in another way. So the drive of the actor can relax a little bit, and you can put that drive into really creating this world and this environment and character that will be on this long running, at this point, this long running TV show.
Is it harder or easier the longer you go? So you've been playing Cooper now for almost 8 years. Like, do you find it like, oh, I know who Cooper is, and I can just, it's much easier to deliver these lines and do the thing? Or do you feel like you have to almost reinvent Cooper every year because of the things that he's gone through as the show's progressed?
That's a great question. I think it's more, I know what he wouldn't do. I know what he will not do. I know that there are lines that he will not cross. I think that that line has been pushed a lot over the years. But, with Reddington, right? Because I have to look the other way a lot, even with some of my own agents. And I think the Cooper in season one would have done it a different way, but he is relaxed a little bit more, as I think you would in real life, as I have as a person. You know, I find my own tolerance of things that would have outraged me and you know, would have made me my blood boil. You know, I'm now more tolerant of, like, for example, even politically, I used to hate conservatives. Republicans, I used to hate them, and now, you know, let them have it, let them be what they are. And I say the same thing about liberals. You know, I used to consider myself a progressive and a Democrat myself, but now I think that it's flip sides of the same coin. And so, you know, I think that the Cooper in many ways has done the same in a different, obviously with different things. He's apolitical in that sense. His drive is really the protection of the United States of America and its sovereignty and the Constitution and so forth. But I think that he realizes in order for that to be secured, that the law cannot be the most important thing. The letter of the law is actually not nearly as important as the spirit of it. The integrity of the United States, its security and apparatuses and so forth, are not so much about the levers that, you know, people pull, the rights, the writs, the compliance, but that has to be undergirding something which is far more important, something more cardinal, like virtue or freedom or justice. You know, you think about things like, and I think it only goes back to the 50s, maybe, where at the Supreme Court, on the West Portico, or it says equal justice under the law. That's very interesting. You know what I mean? And that's what that Supreme Court is, that they are there to have the law, but that the other branches of government, in theory, are there to provide justice, equality, all of that.
And so I was like, you mentioned growing up with the Catholic background. I got the Protestant background for 12 years. And we always were told that law is that rule and that curb. So I always thought it was funny because you talk about, like you were just saying, the road is really, I got the law on each side to keep me in bounds, but the journey is that road and who are the people I walk with down that road. And then I can explore where that road's going to go, if it's going to turn left or turn right. But I always know that I can't go out of bounds.
Guardrails. So
I thought that was real, real fascinating to, I mean, who am I going to bring on the journey with me? That's really the key of life, I think.
That's very good. Where did you get that from, Troy? Is that yours?
No, that's like a Protestant teaching 101. Like the law is a curb, a mirror, and a rule. And then obviously the gospel is the Savior comes down and does everything we need to do and makes it so that we can be here, which is great.
Yeah, I gotta check out some of that. You know what I mean? I'm still trying to get through St. Anselm.
Right.
But I'll work on
it. Bible lessons from Troy. That's what we provide here.
Hey, Aaron's got the priest in his family too. So Pastor.
We're Baptists. Pastors, yeah. Pastor. Yep.
Yep. The Baptists, by the way, are really cool. Well, you know, comparative, everything is comparative in it, really. But the Baptist church was the first ones that allowed black clergymen. They allowed them to, you know, to get ordained and all of that, and to lead services and so forth. The great John Rockefeller, was one of them. He bought a slave couple out of their indentured status, and founded Spelman College, you know, the first black female college in the United States. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I have love for Baptists and Protestants and Jews and Catholics and Buddhists.
Everybody.
Muslims,
we all came from the same place originally. That's the big thing. Right. How do we become one human race and it's all said and done? That's really the goal.
Yeah.
You know, I want to go, I know we jumped to Blacklist, but I want to go back because I wanted to mention Five Heartbeats because I think Robert Townsend is a great director. You've worked with Spike Lee, worked with him, but you took the Five Heartbeats to the stage, right?
Yes. Yes, I did.
And talk to me about that, or talk to the listeners about that. What made you want to bring it to the stage, and what is different for you because you got to do both? Like, what's different for that for you?
Well, you know, I mean, I guess the age of the transfer is you know, we're in it now, real for real. Mm-hmm. But at the time, I don't think there was a whole lot of taking a movie and turning into a play. It's normally the other way around.
The way around, yeah.
But the way that I got into Five Heartbeats is Robert asked me. He belonged to a church out in Los Angeles, and they were building an annex, basically, I think, and they had acquired a theater across the street, which had been a movie theater. So before. And so I was curious because how do you put a play, a musical, onto a movie theater stage? And so we did some renovations and that, and I got really to have a hands-on role in that, you know, in helping to design it, knowing what it is that are required by the actor. At that point, I was a seasoned actor, so I knew that this LA church wouldn't have had a whole lot of experience in that. And, you know, they had some architects and things that worked for the church. And so that was quite a process. And that took a couple of months for them to do the renovations from soup to nuts. And then there's the transfer from the stage, from the screenplay to a stage play. And the thing that was interesting about the movie is it's not a movie musical as such. It is a movie with music.
It's about musicians.
It's about musicians. Mm-hmm. And so how do you do that? And this is always one of the, it's a paradox in a lot of ways. When you're doing a musical, such as Guys and Dolls, and there are musical numbers in that musical, even Singing in the Rain or things like this, you know, you got musical numbers that are contained within a musical. So how do these things distinguish themselves? But I knew that the play could stand for a reconsideration as a theatrical musical. And so that was really the first thing. And I'm not like, I tried out for every musical at Northwestern and was soundly rejected with the poor excuse that they gave me, which was, Harry, you can't sing or dance.
You got that baritone.
I know, but I'll be damned if I sound good using it when I'm singing the song. I sound good in a group, by the way, but I couldn't get in them, but I loved them. And so I studied musicals a lot. And Northwestern has a really crackerjack program, probably the best in the country. Mm. And so I had to work on them as a technician, as a lighting designer, you know, not designer, but somebody running lights and all that. So even my first quarter at Northwestern, I worked on the crew for Pippin, which of course is a great Mark Fosse musical and all
that.
You know, so I was sort of, you know, I knew the form. I knew that there were things about it. Of course, I still don't know.
And they still wouldn't let you sing.
No, they would not. But I love them because there's a certain magical quality to a musical. And I just get to sort of be a kid again and sort of be caught up in the wonder of these people who use music as an extension of speech or use song as what Julie Taymor calls heightened speech. She calls dance heightened movement. You know, it's probably not original to her, but this idea that there is an extension beyond what the human communication normally is, that we can have these forms of expression because, you know, the human body and brain is woefully inadequate to express the nuance and range of emotion that we need to. We have mere words. We have mere gesture. We have, you know, a voice, of course, and a body. But if you think about the hundreds of things you might be feeling in a moment, we cry or we can laugh or we can do nothing. It's really quite a few, you know, limited things that we can do to express the range. But music helps extend that. This, again, gets back into a little bit of Marshall McLuhan, who talks about a medium being an extension of the human form, that a telescope, for example, is an extension of our eyes. Headphones are extensions of our ears and so forth. So I think that that's what fascinated me about it. And to do this with a movie that I had been involved with, which is about some guys in a neighborhood, but we're doing it at a church, and knowing how much music is quite important to the liturgy there, I thought that there would be, if I could collaborate with people who knew that musical form, it would be a cinch. People would love it, eat it up. And I still think that. And they certainly did at the time. And people on the Broadway community had heard about it and sent the Niederlanders came out. They were interested in taking it to Broadway, but there was a rights issue with 20th Century Fox, certain of the songs and so forth. But I knew that we could write a whole bunch of new songs that would be even better, because we did. We had something like 23 songs in that play.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Wow. I wrote one or two of them, you know, and but thank God I didn't have to do more than that. We had some real geniuses at it. But there's some things in musicals that are sort of, you know, what we, you know, recitative and what the Germans call Sprechstimme, where they talk through musical interlude things that church musicians in general sort of don't know about, or, you know, so operetta, musical theater type stuff. So I was able to sort of bring that knowledge with other people into this thing. So it was really great. And at the time I was going through an emotionally difficult time, broken up with my fiance of several years. And so it was a great way to pour into a project all of that angst and pain and joy, really.
And you get to work with some of the greatest people to pull that out of you as an actor. I mean, Spike Lee, the Wachowskis, Joss and Snyder. Any particular favorites or styles that you gravitated towards, or, you know, what do you think they each brought out of you as an actor as you went through your career?
When you think about the people you mentioned, I was sort of at that point having worked with them all and enjoyed them for the most part all, you know, I think the one that sort of pulled the most out of me is Julie Taymor doing Titus. Because, you know, in that environment, I'm working with, you know, arguably the greatest actor, you know, of his time. I don't even know if it's arguable. Anthony Hopkins, you know, so you're going to have to be ready. You got Alan Cumming in it. You got the great Angus McFadden. You got Matthew Rhys, Jonathan Rhys Meyers, the amazing, legendary Jessica Lange. So, you know, you had to be at the top of your game in that field. And Julie and I had done, Julie directed me in Titus Andronicus 2 years before, 3 or 4 years before that. On film.
That's Shakespeare, so Shakespeare's already hard enough.
It's already hard. We were in Rome. But I had a very big head start. I had done the play with her and those other act and knew her language and worked with her. And so she really pushed me to discover new things working with this new cast. So that was a really great opportunity that you don't get a lot. Taking it from stage to screen in a Shakespeare in Rome. And then the actor, my adversary in the movie is Lucius Andronicus, who is played by Angus McFadden. And we literally worked on our parts every night after dinner and drinks. We would go back to the room and he pushed the hell out of me. So I was really grateful for that entire process. But all of them are great. You know, Taylor Hackford was a really good director. Spike is really more of he lets you do the acting, and you know, he casts well. I think Woody Allen once said 90% of the job is casting. Mm-hmm. Somebody said it, or maybe he said 90% of the job is just showing up or something. But I think Chuck Smith is another great director I've worked with on stage in Chicago, and he believes that casting is really the most important thing because the actor is going to do his work. And a director really is kind of just, you know, pushing you in a direction you're already going, thinking about the bigger picture and how you fit into it. And I'm that kind of actor really that I don't need all the lines or all of the screen time. If I know my role and what you need on the team, I'm going to do that. So, you know, like Magic Johnson knew his role was the point guard. Dennis Rodman knew his role was the rebounder and the rim protector.
Sometimes,
I do a lot of that. What did you say?
Sometimes Rodman, he could go other places.
Irritant. Yeah. Draymond Green, you know, he's a guy today in the game that, you know, he doesn't care if he scores 0 points, but you want him on the floor. You want him on the floor all the time.
For sure. Oh, Draymond. Yeah. Now all I can think about is that Dave Chappelle joke. Have you ever heard the Dave Chappelle joke where he's like, Draymond Green's name is so black when he logs into Airbnb, they log him out? That's a great joke.
That's true.
I'm quoting Dave Chappelle. Don't nobody write me.
That's very good. I like it. I got another one for you. I was watching one of these Agatha Christie things with Peter Ustinov playing Poirot the other day, and I think it might have been Diana Riggs. The question was, no, somebody said on it, and it might have been the great James Mason that said, you know, it's not right and it's not fair. And one of the actresses, Diana Rigg or somebody, said, that sounds like a black man's left leg.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah, that was very funny.
You know, I kind of wanted to, I mean, and I know it's coming from a white guy, but I'm still going to ask. The evolution for you as a black actor, African-American actor in America, how has that been for you? I mean, I don't know if it really gets talked about enough because you started in this business and it's been 30 years, 30 plus years. Has that evolution been what's that experience been like for you, I guess? Because I know it's changed a lot and diversity is much more important in Hollywood now than it used to be.
You know, I've been asked similar questions, Aaron, and my response, I think it still holds, which is that I don't have anything to compare it to. So I would have to know what it's like to be a white actor. Similarly,
me either.
Yeah. You still have a chance, brother.
Never know.
Yeah, you never know. And you never know with the black thing, too.
I know. I'm not taking that chance.
If I want to be a girl, you know, in 5 minutes, I can decide if I want to be white next time. So, but that said, I don't know. I think that there are more opportunities. The question becomes, are they better opportunities? And I think writ large, not necessarily.
Hmm.
Right? I think that if you look at the quality of the work and the quality of the roles offered on the whole, it's not better. People are still playing slaves and butlers and maids and you know, derelicts and things of this nature. And I have no interest in that, you know, wallowing in trauma and a lack of achievement. I don't want to do that. That's not cool for me. So my solution and method has really been to create work of my own and, you know, work with those people who are in alignment with that. And there have been people over the years, like you mentioned many of them, Troy, you know, the Zack Snyder's and the stuff who's been a joy to work with, by the way. And
I'm coming back to him. Don't worry. We're not leaving without talking to Zack Snyder.
He's great. I enjoyed, you know, what I did with Taylor Hackford. I enjoyed what I do most of the time. I enjoy The Blacklist. I enjoy Billions. These are, you know, not lead roles per se most of the time, but they are nonetheless rich. And I think that you could do, it goes back to our earlier thing about long life, longevity. I think Dr. King said best. He says, longevity has its place, but I'm really not worried about that now. He said he's worried about, you know, the getting to the other side, getting to the mountaintop, really. And so I think that's my concern really as well, more than looking at it from a shallow point of view, volume of roles and mediums on which to be acting has not necessarily resulted in an increase of the quality. And I think that's going to take time and development and encouraging the black writers. It doesn't even matter if they're black, really, but people who will write the stories, the narratives that are interesting, compelling, dimensionalized, nuanced, have development, are epic in scale, the stuff that August Wilson was doing. And several people today, there are very, very many talented writers out there today. They just haven't been given the access to, you know, the audience that I think that they deserve. But they're out there.
I keep looking forward to the day when, you know, we interview people and we talk to people. When you don't say actor, actress, black actor, Asian American, you know, any of that. When it's just actor or just director. And that's really the only conversation that you have. I'm really looking forward to that.
But, you know, Aaron, I think something interesting is happening now. Now you've got people complaining when actors are playing a disabled person, and if you don't cast a disabled actor, you know, somebody will fight it. If you got actors who are voice acting and they're on The Simpsons or whatever, you know, people apologizing for the roles that that's what actors do.
Yeah, I know.
So I think actually people are getting more and more siloed in a way in the thinking about it, the sort of acting theory. I like to think about acting as a science and the theory. And I think that there are enemies to the kind of age-old traditions of, if I'm an actor, I should be able, if I so choose, to play anything as long as I bring integrity and all of these things to it. So, you know what I mean? So in any case, for many good reasons, there are people who have expressed concerns about actors' ability to play this or that. But I don't know that that's a good thing. I think that we are in a specialized profession that should have protections from the kind of political agenda of people outside of the industry who start clamoring on about things that are wacky. There was some group called Color for Change or something like this that listed The Blacklist about a year, you know, when all this thing jumped off in March, the Black Lives Matter thing. And they're saying that, you know, that the roles of the black actors on the blacklist are problematic in some way because they're crooks. It's like, it's a show about criminals, you moron. Why don't you mind your business and go deal with the stuff that, you know, that you actually are praising? The stuff that's on, you know, these second-rate networks and cable channels that are truly offensive. Things that you're giving Academy Awards to, things like, you know, people playing slaves and butlers and so forth, which is trash. And then they give these people awards and it's really setting us back in a lot of ways. So there's not a lot of deep thinking about the real messaging that is going on and about the real content that's putting out. People are content to appease, you know, black people in general and the populace as a whole. And then, figuratively pissing on their legs and telling them it's raining. But it's nonsense. You know what I mean? The American story is a story of the outlaw, of the reject, who defines his own destiny and goes out there and achieves it. Where we lionize, you know, the outlaw who goes against the grain. You know, getting back to Troy's metaphor about the road and the boundaries thereof. And so we should be embracing that, somebody that rejects the law of an unjust society and goes and makes his own way, who relishes in being outside of the law in that sense. The early Christian movement in itself did this. Use the road system created by the Roman Empire to suppress progress, to propagate the faith. And we're outside of the law all the time, but loved that. And couldn't wait to be martyred so that they could inspire a generation to come. So anyway, that I'm on their side.
Yeah, it's almost like we did ourselves a disservice by coming up with the word typecasting. Like, there's no type. You're an actor. You should be able to act anything if you're a good actor.
If you're a good actor, yeah. You should get the opportunity. Everybody should get the opportunity. That's how it should work.
And well, maybe not. Maybe everybody shouldn't.
Well, I mean, everybody can fail, too. I mean, if you suck at it.
I mean, if you're talking about broad categories of group, yeah, precisely. That's my point, Aaron. But if you're talking about categories of people who should be getting represented realistically, yes, then that pool should increase. Our definition of things like what is classic, what is excellent. But, you know, but as much as we should broaden the participants in it, I believe we should have a more narrow stricture on what is excellent within it. Because I think now, you know, just because, you know, this everybody gets a trophy attitude about, oh, you know, somebody's son got a role in something and they're black or a woman had never played it before, or a fat guy never, or, you know, a short
fat person. Guy never you played know, it before.
You know what I mean? Like, what are the standards? As much as we are worried about the inclusion of those people who have been disallowed, we should also be strict about what is excellent within it. And this goes all the way through the education system. Now you can't study this. You can't read Huckleberry Finn in some places. You can't read, you know, X, Y, or Z, where we're practicing censorship and not actual criticism. And I think it's a great detriment. And people use these conflagrations, such as what was going on in D.C. with these people, you know, as an excuse to further erode the things that actually we need to be protecting.
Yeah, we need to be protecting the concepts of what makes us what's our individual self that brings to the table a piece that the world needs to hear, but yet act in a respectful manner of all people. So that way you can actually have that experience and let your experience shine by being supported by the cast of everybody else around you.
Amen, Troy. You sound like a Protestant preacher.
Well, and it's really what Dr. King was talking about, right? He's like, he's up there and it's driven from much like Black Lives Matter was over this past year. You know, yes, Black Lives Matter, 100%, you know, but he really wanted just like, can we just be human? Like, there is no race, and racism is a, what do you want to call it? Like, it's an evilness. It's a thing in your brain, right? There is no such thing as we are one human race. And like, how do we get to be that? Because when the Vulcans and the Dorians and whatever else is coming from Star Trek and Star Wars to invade. Like, we got to be one people.
That's true. I mean, you know, that is the one thing that would get us all together very quickly, is if foreign alien intelligence of outer space came in and threatened us. We'd get together then.
In 2000 was crazy enough to even see those metal obelisks from 2001 in three different places, which was really, really crazy.
I can honestly say I've never heard Vulcans be introduced as part of a race discussion, but thank you, Troy.
Go watch season 3 of Star Trek Discovery and you'll actually,
I don't have that kind of
run on there too, between their memory. Own selves.
All right. Well, go back to Zack Snyder. All right. So speaking of Snyder, because when you and I were at C2E, I don't even know if you remember, because you do do you? Oh, sweet. We talked about that. And we talked about, you know, I'm not going to speak for you, but how much I love them. I love those movies. And I didn't, as a critic, don't really care what other critics feel about it, because I think they're wrong. I don't think they have a full appreciation for it. That's a personal opinion. And we were talking about those. And I kind of want to get or ask you on the record, like, how do you feel about working on those films? And like the response that it got, because I feel like it was an unfair response compared to many other movies that are out there in similar veins. And are you, and also what did it feel like to work on those kinds of, I mean, those aren't just movies. Those are multi-million dollar blockbuster, huge mega projects.
Well, what I like about them and working on them is the serious approach, you know, almost, there's a website or something. I just found out about it yesterday from some of the young crew on the Blacklist, called Every Frame a Painting or something like this. It's called Every Frame a Painting. And it looks at filmmakers and talks about how really it's moving pictures and so forth. And so I think, anyway, Zach takes that kind of approach to it. I think he thinks of it as giving classic film treatment, classic composition in terms of paintings and artwork, subject matter, you know, and this is something I think that the superhero genre does well, is that it is a kind of surrogate for theological consideration. You know, if you think of Superman and these people as really gods, you know, it becomes what they would say in Latin is in loco Dei, in the place of a god. And so I think that the reverence that Zach has in terms of the way he puts that story together, even just visually, you know, giving it the scale, the almost David Lean-like, you know, epic treatment, you know, in popular entertainment without merely resorting to sensational, bombastic colors and explosions, you know, like he's really sort of painting a picture. And I think he thinks of it in that way. And so it's really cool to hear him talk. He really about it while you're working with him. And when he's not even on the set, you know, he's studying. He is looking at the movies that inspired him, taking the ideas of the people, perhaps some of, even in his generation, the Wachowskis, for example. I think he was influenced by certainly what happened in The Matrix, you know, the way that the sort of groundbreaking thing that it did for popular entertainment, the way we think about these subject matters. I even think that something like the Richard Donner Superman back in the 80s with Christopher Reeve was beautifully done. But the subject matter that I think DC characters universe does is a kind of darker, more mature approach to it. Whereas, and these are very broad strokes I'm painting in, whereas the Marvel characters seem to be, you know, more about titillating and sensationalizing these things. I'm not putting it down anyway. I think it is designed for mass entertainment. It's really kind of for a younger, I think in many ways, adrenaline-fueled type of thing, where you're stimulating people with color and sound and size and throwing everything sort of, you know, you got all of them in a movie. And many times they were first out of the gate with that. Justice League was kind of laid out of the box with putting them all together, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But I like I like that about Zach a lot, and you know, he's an old school guy, even though he's a young man. I think he went to the Pacific School of Art and Design, which is where he graduated from. But he was first a commercial director, and that's mm-hmm. where he met Kevin Costner. He's directing some stuff over in Europe. But Costner, you know, you can make a lot of money doing commercials over there and be an A-list star. And then over time, you know, he had his shot with Dawn of the Dead and redefined the zombie genre, which is still going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, absolutely. I think that he's a visionary guy. He's a hell of a nice guy. And working with somebody who treats you like a colleague and a collaborator at that scale, you know, when you're doing budgets of that size and you have that kind of time, and that could be very intimidating. You can get on the set, and I've been on those sets. You know, I was, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. in The Matrix 2 and 3, loved the Wachowskis. Working with them, there are a couple of Chicago guys like myself. We had a lot in common. You know, I'm on the set with Cornel West. But these kind of directors treat popular entertainment like it's sacred. And anybody that does that, that has that approach, that reconsiders it, that retrieves, as it were. And I keep getting back to McLuhan, but who retrieves something that was in obsolescence, this kind of popcorn genre, you know, that had sort of fallen into disrepute in a way, in terms of serious consideration. And then retrieving it from obsolescence and putting it back into the fore, I think is doing a great service and is in line with that McLuhan idea. And, you know, I guess in summation, I would say that, you know, I feel that we haven't seen the best of Zack Snyder yet. And I am delighted to tell you that I'm going to be, you know, part of the Justice League.
Yay! I just peed myself.
Right. So, yeah.
Oh, so you're part of the 4-hour Opus event.
Evidently. I haven't seen it. obviously. I know that it's seeable because he sent out a tweet and he tagged me on it where he had it in the can, where it said, "Hey man, it's done."
That's awesome.
Somebody's looking at it right now.
I was going to ask you, but I'm just glad you just brought it up yourself.
Yeah.
Now, was that existing footage or was that part of the reshoots that he did?
It was both. You know, I think he shot very little new footage. I think he probably treated what was there already. I believe that Joss probably threw out a great deal and did a lot of reshooting. So he was the one that was doing all of the reshooting.
Right.
And I have no hesitation in saying that I think that people will greatly prefer what is coming, since we already know what it was that Joss saw as it. And you know, I know that's what it wasn't intended to be. And I don't blame anybody for, you know, how could you take what's in somebody's brain and heart and then put that up there? You have to sort of follow your own heart.
He was given a very difficult task for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's tough.
And I'm excited because I haven't actually seen the first.
What?
So. No, I was waiting. I wanted to see if we'd get the real version of it. So
no, you didn't
see the real.
You
version.
Didn't avoid it in the theater because you thought we'd eventually get Zack Snyder's version. You just didn't want to see it.
We just didn't want to see it.
Yeah, Joss has never seen it. I'm sorry, no, Zack has never seen Joss's version.
I probably, if I was him, I probably wouldn't either. Honestly, I mean, and not because of anything critical. Yeah. Just, you know, that was his baby, and yeah, I get that.
Yeah, you know, but you bring up something very interesting, Aaron, which is sort of, you know, the people dismissed it. And it's, you know, it's, I don't know what they're expecting. I think they're looking for Raging Bull. And this is, you know, this isn't, you know, they're sort of judging it by a standard that is not fair to judge it as critics. Like, how realistic, or as it were, whatever their complaints are, you expect it to be. It's about big ideas, big characters, big personae. And you know, you can't, unless you do a 12-hour movie, You know, there are going to be some stuff that you have to use your imagination and bring to what do you think of what is there? You know, this is something that I don't know if it's George Bernard Shaw, I think it was, who was a critic before he became a writer himself. But he said that, you know, the real job of the critic is not to tell the director, writer, actor, whatever, what to do.
Mm-hmm.
But to judge what it was that they set out to do.
Exactly.
What their intention was.
100%.
Right. And then to determine whether or not they achieved that, you know, and they, or if they could have, and if they could have, where they might have reconsidered what it was that they did. But that's the true job. And there's very little, if any, criticism out there. These are people, fanboys, who know nothing about filmmaking, storytelling, and it just said what they would do or what they would have. And it's like, well, you know, make your own movie.
Oh, man. Well, they're going to start writing your name somewhere now.
Please. Let them come.
But you're right. You're absolutely right. And as a critic myself, that is one thing that I think is very important that most critics do, most real critics do, but there are many that don't, is you can't judge something based on what you want. It doesn't, what you want shouldn't matter at all, and it shouldn't be a factor. It should be stopped at the door. As soon as you walk through the theater door, it shouldn't matter.
Right. That's right. Don't go next time. You know, don't see it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Nobody if you cares. Didn't, if you didn't like Man of Steel, you're probably not going to like Batman versus Superman. You're just probably not.
Man of Steel was terrific.
I had maybe one issue. I'm like, maybe he could have saved his dad. Outside of that, I love that movie.
Yeah.
So that's really my only thing. But I get too. The reasoning.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think Kent died in the Richard Donner version. So you got to get rid of him.
Yep. You got to get out of there somehow.
True.
I get it.
Before we hitch up on some rapid fire blacklist ones here, we just have one fan question. They just want to know, like, what did you do to find joy during the pandemic?
Oh yeah. Wow. That's great. You know, joy is such a great word. It is the most powerful little word, I think, in the English language. Joy. Deeper than happiness and, you know, kicks and having your fun. Joy. What is it that wakes you up and gives you the strength to go on and so forth? And during that time, I guess the joy that I found, for the most part, was that everybody was in a common place. I mean, we were all sort of reset. We were all brought back to a sort of basic line of humanity. And we were, I think, really rooting for each other. I was here in New York during the vast majority of it. And then my wife and I, who is a source of great joy, Gina, she and I went on the road. We took like a month-long trip through the eastern part, you know, although, you know, I guess the Missouri River was our sort of border.
Oh, that's great.
But, yeah, it really was. Yeah. And it was so strange because the first place we stopped was Richmond, Virginia. And we went to the Monument Row and we went and saw Kehinde Wiley's, you know, statue, which was sort of an answer to those statues, which, you know, before the day we left, you know, we're standing there. The Robert E. Lees and the other traitors are there. But the minute we left, the next night, it went crazy. We then got to, I think our next stop was Atlanta. And we arrived in Atlanta as it was jumping off, man. Like we had family, we visited family and friends there. The CNN Center was, you know, was catching, you know, hell. And then we went on to Houston. There were demonstrations. We went on to Dallas, demonstration. We went up to Oklahoma City. So we were sort of like
following you around.
We were like the pale horse. But
come on, guys, next city, let's go. Let's go.
But nonetheless, you know, it was great to see people, connect with people in that crazy time. And so family, my wife was included, of course, in that. And then I got better at the piano. You know, I had sort of fallen off with practicing in that. So I had a lot of time on my hands. I wrote a musical about the Book of Ruth, which is one of my favorite books in the Bible.
Great book.
Very short, very short book in the Bible, the second shortest book in the whole Bible, in the Old Testament, I should say, 4 chapters. So anyway, that is in development now.
Excellent.
I was busy. I was busy.
Good. Are you going to sing?
I'm not going to be in it at all. You won't see me in it.
He wrote the thing. He lived it.
That's funny.
Right. Unless they let me play Ruth, you know, we'll see.
Which you should be able to do because it's just about if you can hack the right?
Oh, boy.
So 8 years on the blacklist now. What has been like the craziest thing that you've done with the show? What's been like the hardest thing you've done with the show? I mean, it's been a family. I mean, it's 150 plus episodes. That's a lot of TV in this day and age for one series.
Yeah, it's a lot. I don't really get to do crazy, you know, fortunately, I guess, you know, the character's been in dire situations, but I haven't had to go kick down a lot of doors, you know, hang from bridges and things like my buddy Diego Kladenhoff gets to do. You know, he had to dive into the river and the pilot and all kinds of stuff. He was on shootouts and on the highway, which they had closed down. The pilot was directed by Joe Carnahan, by the way, who did Smoking Aces and stuff. So that was, you know, very adrenaline filled. But
we're,
I haven't.
We're big fans of Joe's just from the 24 days.
Joe's great. Joe's great.
Yeah, you were on 24 too.
I sure did. I was wondering if you were going to catch that, Aaron.
Season six,
yep. One of the best seasons.
Yeah, I did 6 episodes of it. So there you go. But I think that, you know, my character really is the, you know, for lack of a better, I don't hope it's not provocative. I'm the black hole. I hold things together. Things get pulled into a kind of stable place when Cooper's around. That's what he's there to do. Megan Boone and Jane Spader's characters are really sort of the electromagnetism of the show. They're out there spinning but people come back to get coalesced to the, what we call the war room, the post office. So, I think what's the craziest thing? Yeah. You know, we've had a lot of stability on the show. We are a family. And I think in many ways I get to hold that. Like I'm the center on the team, so to speak. I'm Tim Duncan, so to speak.
You know what I find interesting, and I think I told you this when I saw you, is that you are so much, for people that they've never met you, you're so much like Cooper. I mean, really, as a person, you have that genuine, I don't want to say father figure-esque. I mean, just about you, like where you walk into a room and people, I mean, you garner immediate respect, and it's based on how you carry yourself and your general demeanor, your attitude, just everything about you is just, you have a very gravitas. You have gravitas. I mean, you just walk in a room and people are like, damn, you know, and that's, and I don't know if you even realize how much like Cooper you seem, because I mean, I've seen your other work. You act, you can act. So it's not like I'm just playing the same guy and everything, you know, you act. This is just very, from what I've witnessed, a very similar character to you, other than you don't break any laws ever, I'm sure.
You know, thank you. First of all, that means a lot. And clearly you've seen a pretty big swath of the stuff that I've done. So
I need to watch less stuff. That's really what I need to do. Go outside.
Well, you got it. Don't stop until you see my movies. I'll send you guys some links to the three movies that I've been able to. I financed them, produced them. One of them I wrote and produced. This is a movie called Revival. But in any case,
absolutely.
Pardon me?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. Great. We'll get that to you. But that said, you know, something that my favorite actor of all time, probably, I have many. But probably the guy that holds the title of the guy that if I could do that, you know, is the great Charles Laughton.
Mm.
He said it took him many years to be comfortable playing himself. You know, I mean, if you look at his early work, playing King Henry VIII, for example, and other things when he was a young man, he did a lot. and he was playing, you know, older characters a lot. But it took him a while to be comfortable bringing himself to the equation. And I think that that comes along, you know, along with time on the task, experience in the business, a level of comfort with yourself. And that is an acquired thing. There's no shortcut to that. But I think, you know, at this point, you know, I've earned the right to some extent to bring Harry to Harold and to sort of base Harold on, you know, my own temperament, at least. Some of the circumstances of his life, you know, are different. As you say, he's a law-abiding person, probably. He drinks a lot. He seems to drink at least pretty
He's always got booze in that desk, yeah.
We looked for it. We couldn't find it when we were there, but
yeah, when we were there, we did look for the booze. I'm just saying that. I think you took it.
I look for it myself, believe me, because what they really get me is flavored, you know, water.
That's just depressing.
Colored water, which, you know. But yeah, but I think, you know, he's obviously got some issues, you know, I don't think he's an alcoholic or anything, but you know, he has the wife that, you know, and
yeah, that's a sad story. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's things, you know, that he's working on. I think he has legitimate attachments to the people on the, that work for him, but there's something that, you know, there's lots of room to explore with Cooper. What does it look like when he knocks off work? We really don't get to, we don't follow him around as much as some of the other characters. You know, he hasn't had any other romances, and you're not going to his apartment. And, you know,
that's true.
Yeah. It's true. So
it's see him in his pajamas, which I assume are just another suit.
or it's the jammies that actually look like a suit.
Yeah.
Right. That's right.
There was a big fan contention for a while about Ewan Panabaker actually having some kind of a side thing, like a poker game or maybe doing a whatever on the side. Like there was a big group going for a long time around season 4, season 5.
Hey, I'm open for it. She's a great gal, by the way. Dee Dee Lovejoy, Deirdre Lovejoy, wonderful actress and actor, as you would have it, Troy. I enjoy working with. We have great guest stars and recurring characters. What a team, of course, that Red assembled. And of course, our guy Clark, who we lost not too long ago.
Yeah.
We had Reggie Cathy on the show, like in season 3 or 4, passed away not too long ago. But, you know, but we get the cream of the crop here in New York and LA and other places where we pull them from. But yeah, you know, like I'm game to, I think Cooper, you know, has some things in his life that people don't know about. You know, maybe he, you know, is a great pool hustler, or, you know, cheats at cards or something, and has a secret stash of cash someplace. But I think he's an interesting person, and it's always good to have some place to go if the writers so decide. But I'm happy with the job as it is, but you know, I'm always up for a challenge and always up for, you know, some change, something unexpected.
I want the episode now where Cooper's at a, it, you know, it's like a hotel lounge or a jazz club or something at the piano, since you can play the piano now. You know, like Red has to come in and meet you somewhere, and you're just sitting at the piano just tickling the ivories. I think that'd be awesome.
But he has to wait until I'm done with that set.
Exactly. Right?
I'm on my 10-minute break. Yeah.
I want the staple. I want the TV staple where you wake up, you got a gun, you got blood all over you, you don't remember what happened, you probably were blackout drunk from the jazz club. And then you have to piece it together with Red's help. That's what I want to see. That'd before be cool the end of the series.
That's a very cool story. It reminds me of The Godfather Part 2, right? Yep. When that senator wakes up and he's like, what?
What happened? And then you go and you got to piece it back together.
That's a great scene, by the way.
Yes.
I don't like the, you know, but the fact that he's already been such an ass to Michael Corleone. Tell him that he doesn't like you people coming to this town.
It's a great film. Moments. Yeah. Absolutely.
That guy's great. Yeah.
We got the Kuwait story like way early. Was that first episode of season 2 after you almost died, right, at the season 1 conclusion. And then we finally get the Kuwait backstory. What did you think of the Kuwait backstory finally coming to fruition? And what's it like having to teach another actor, a younger version of Cooper, how to be Cooper?
You know, the great thing about Kuwait, the actor who played me, Ruffin Prentice, all he really had to do was look at, you know, the show.
Seven years of research right there.
7 years of research. Yeah. Right there. It's kind of like, you know, not comparing myself, obviously, but all De Niro had to do to play the young Vito Corleone is look at the movie Godfather and impersonate Marlon Brando. But, you know, I don't think Ruffin did that. I think that was smart. You know, he sort of, in a way, I really appreciated that because it helped establish that whatever happened in Kuwait, those things that we see a glimpse into, changed this man. You know what I mean? That was sort of the genesis of the relationship that Cooper had with Reddington. And he was changed thereafter. You know, I remember Reddington comes up to Cooper. He says, "I forget, Harold, how handsome he used to be." So that's always good when a handsome actor gets to play a younger version.
Yeah.
I get to live vicariously in a way through myself. So who gets to do that? But I loved it. I thought it was, I'm trying to put into words how much of a privilege it is to be on a show that's really good. And you get the opportunity, you know, to actually do some research and some work. That's the most fun for me as an actor in my process, such as it is the research and the sort of working out logistically, mechanically in many ways. What can I know about this man? What can I know about the times that he lived in? What can I know about, you know, that situation that they were involved in? What happened in Kuwait? And, you know, I actually had some friends who served over there. And so, you know, I mean, I don't, obviously this is a fiction. And so, you know, there's only a certain amount that you could do. And the real great fun, and I think about this with movies such as Shine. Remember that great movie starring Jeffrey Rush and, the guy who played him, Noah something, I can't remember his last name, who played the young Jeffrey Rush, was so great. And he really did have to work. But, you know, Jeffrey Rush gets the Oscar.
That's really true. I didn't even, that's a great point. You know? He worked really hard at that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when you sometimes you get that. Like Brando's performance looks even better after De Niro play, you know.
That's true.
So that's a lot of fun. And so just as, you know, that's really not the work I was talking about, but that kind of opportunity to do a speech where, you know, you're listening to the actor who played opposite me in that, who played Daniel, I can't remember the character's name, but this actor's name was Piper. He was wonderful actor. It was just a lot of fun. And, you know, they gave me some rope and I got to, you know, to go out on it a little bit.
In that episode, you know, what I thought was most prominent, at least I don't know what Troy was hoping for. Troy was hoping for this huge random connection to the Reddington mythology. I mean, a much deeper, deep. He wanted you to be, I don't know, I think Red Reddington. I don't really know anymore what Troy wants. But in terms of the mythology, were you kind of hoping as an actor that maybe Harold is more connected to Reddington than we know, at least at this point, obviously, like in that episode?
It's an interesting question. I think no. And I say that because the character that you referenced earlier, Boyd Langton, you know, winding up really being the source of Rossum or whatever the name of the company was.
Well, don't spoil it for when I watch the show in 12 years.
I blew it. That's right. Well, sorry.
That's okay. Saves me time.
But I think we need to keep them separate in many ways just for it to work. I think that there always has to be a polar opposite. There has to be, as much as Reddington is unpredictable and all of those things, in order for that to work, I think Cooper needs to hold the line. on his side of it. And I think sometimes, you know, it's, you need Mr. Rogers, you know, and that he could really be, after all, a good guy and a decent man and somebody who believes in his oath and that. And I don't know that necessarily having a closer tie to Reddington or my theory had always been, by the way, that Cooper is actually Liz Keene's father.
Hey, I like it.
That's a great, that's a new one.
I like it. It makes sense. You
she's
know,
like you're like a father figure to me. She says the same thing you guys say, but maybe he is. No, but I doubt it. I doubt if that's the case. But that said,
that'd be fantastic.
That would be fun.
That would be fun.
You heard it here, folks.
Woohoo!
So are you the better dad? I'm good with it. Are you the better dad, or is Red the better dad?
Oh man, I think you know, it's curious. I don't know if Cooper has children of his own. And that's interesting because that's obviously true. As the actor who plays the character, as I said earlier, you want to know as much about the character as possible.
Mm-hmm.
But in a show like this, a long-running show when the writer, the creator of that character may decide something completely different,
mm-hmm.
maybe hasn't decided it yet. You know, sometimes you actually do have to not know everything. So you have to be actually able at some point. And I don't believe that it's been operative if he himself has had children. I, Harry Lennox, don't have children. Mm. But people are always calling, you know, I got all kinds of surrogate daughters and stuff. So I think that the easy answer to that would be that Cooper is a better father. But I think Red Reddington, if he is her father, and I like to think that he is, I don't think that he is, but I like to think that he is.
I'm glad you clarified that because somebody was probably writing a letter right now.
I don't know. I don't know the thing. I don't know. And I'm glad that I don't. But I think the Cooper is not as good a father as Reddington. He's certainly not willing to go through, you know, to the lengths that Reddington is to protect her, I don't think. I mean, Reddington would kill the world to save this girl.
Mm-hmm.
That's a hell of a love. It might not be the most functional or most politically correct kind of love, but that's the duty that he sees it. And for him, it seems to be a holy mission, a crusade. And so I think on that level, he's a better father. I mean, you want Reddington on your side, in spite of what you may think of him. It's kind of like, you know, play a basketball. I keep with these basketball references. I'll switch to baseball next year. But but you want Michael Jordan, in spite of the fact that he's an ass or whatever, you want him on your side.
Yes, you do. You always want Michael Jordan on your side.
Well, I think it's interesting, too, because you had that one episode, I think it was season 5, where you had to go to bat for the kid from the old neighborhood. And Cooper kind of got out of his element a little bit, where we were all kind of like, wait, I thought Cooper was the law, and now he's breaking the law to try to like do everything he can for this kid. I think that's the what would Cooper think if he had a son? And I think that's what he was going through in that episode.
Yeah, we had a big debate. Like, I don't know if Cooper would do that. You know, we're like,
yeah, I think that he would, and I say that, and I think though he wouldn't have perhaps done it in season 1, but I think that he's been influenced by Reddington.
Mm.
Reddington's willing to do this for somebody because there is a higher good than what might be on the law books. And I think that this kid, you know, Cooper knows that there are some things that the law by itself cannot handle, or cannot be handled according to its permit, as it were. And he's willing to do it. And I think it's worth it to him. I love that episode because it's a surprise, because it's, you know, because you're not expecting that from this.
I was not. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, you know, that's the strange thing. You know, we say this about Shakespeare a lot, those of us who still do it, but
who can decipher it?
Who can decipher it?
Yeah.
If it's well done, by the way, there's no problem. You know, like,
I agree 100%. Yeah, I agree.
Well done, yep. You don't have any trouble with it.
But if you read it, if you read it, you need an interpreter. At times.
Right. Like, that's true.
What does he say? What? Who doth what?
Although, you know, that's modern English, early modern, yep. But it's modern English. And so it should be completely comprehensible. That's what we're here for. We're here to
interpret it.
Play it. Yeah, it's not really, you know, there's age old debate, Aaron, about Shakespeare better left to the closet, you know, the closet play where you read it in your room, mm-hmm. and so forth, where the scholars line up, or for we who are practitioners, you know, that it's a play. And so it's better to be performed. But
absolutely.
That said, there are characters who do things in Shakespeare all the time that make no logical sense. If he had to deal with a modern movie story editor, producer, they'd demand, get the hell out of here with that, Shakespeare. Why is Titus Andronicus killing his own son? Why is, Lear, weeping now when he cursed the girl after she's dead? Why did she say this to her father when she, lying to him, knowing that she's lying, knowing that it will have consequence, but she is the virtuous heroine? And I'm talking about Cordelia. Mm-hmm. Because people do things that are inconsistent all the time. They are consistently inconsistent.
Excellent. And I think point.
That's the stuff of great character and drama.
I love that you said that, because a lot of times especially when you talk to actors who play characters who are very, like you said earlier, you know your character. You know, a lot of times people will get in the, my character would never do that. And I love that you say that. Yeah. A lot of times we all know people that were put under certain circumstances or certain strains, and then they do something that is out of character. I mean, that does happen. And Shakespeare was very good at that.
Yep. But yeah, we did talk about that earlier. I know what Cooper would not do. Mm-hmm. But that did not arouse my spidey senses in any way. I was like, okay. I think Cooper's a badass. I mean, that's why he's reliable on this side of the law. And I think about my own brother, who was 30 years in law enforcement, an Illinois state trooper commander there. He could have gone in the old days, my other brother Larry, too, the one who passed away. Mm. They could have gone on either side of the law. We were in a highly recruiting gang neighborhood at the time on the south side of Chicago. The gangs came over there trying to recruit, but they didn't come twice because these guys were bad. They nice. Were tough. Not just them. I mean, the entire block. We had, Muslims, and we had people just coming up from Mississippi, and we had some, some kids that had been around a while, street urchins, but we weren't interested in joining their gang. Some of the guys on the block, but they were not to be toyed with. And I think Cooper comes from a similar environment. It would stand to reason. Mm-hmm. He's been in the military, in Kuwait and Afghanistan, probably, and places like that. So he's hardened by battle. He's a patriot, and he's not playing that. And so I like seeing, at least thinking about that.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, you at season four, right at the end, you pull out this bloody shirt with the 30-year-old DNA that clearly is going to match to Liz's, because that was her father at that point in time. But a code name came out, Sea Duke. And that's the only time in the series we've heard that come up. And fans have been speculating for 4 years now, like, what does Sea Duke have to do with the whole? So questions, Harry, who do you think Sea Duke is? And is he actually a bigger part of the story in season 8? Or she, for that matter, because we don't know.
Or they.
Or they.
How they're identifying it. No, I have no idea. I wouldn't, Troy, in all honesty, I feel ashamed that I have no recollection.
but many people have no idea where Troy comes up with this stuff, honestly.
But hey.
Remember, I got the insane asylum named after me in season 5, so that's, how John feels about it.
That's very cool. Yeah. That's very cool. Which John? Isaac John?
Boca Camp.
Okay. Yeah, he's a hoot.
He's a hoot.
They're both a hoot.
They seem like great guys to work for.
They are. Yeah.
And with.
Well, we should say that you introduced us, actually, when you did the Behind the Blacklist specials. So,
oh, that's right.
Yeah. You did me in season 4 and then the both of us in season, that was season 6 to 7, season 5 to 6.
He's been trying to forget it, Troy. I don't blame him.
No, I remember. I remember it well. I had such a blast, hosting those things.
Those are great.
Yeah, they're fun. You know, a lot of fun.
It was like, mystery solved. Red is, in fact, an alien. And I was like, I never saw that coming.
That's right. You know, I think I've got it figured out, though, to be honest. Like I said, I don't want to know, but I think I'm onto something.
Do you? Do you want to share it, or do you want to keep it to yourself? No, because no matter what, everybody will take you for what you say, and they'll be like, "Oh, that's Harry said this."
Well, and if he ends up being right, then he's definitely in trouble, right?
That's right. Then I'm out of a job. I tell you what, the next time I see you two guys,
okay,
in Chicago, we'll have a couple, knock a couple back, a la Cooper,
some caramel colored water for sure.
Yeah, or when you come to New York and you come to the office, I'll have a real bottle and we'll knock it, and I will let you know what I think.
There you go.
I am dying for that. That'll happen. Absolutely. Well, I think we've taken a lot of your time, and I hope it was worth it for you. I mean, we had a great time.
As did I.
I do got to ask for the fans. Is there anything left that you can tease about Cooper or season 8 that's coming up that you can talk about?
We left off, I think, what we only showed two of them.
It's only two. So, yeah, episode 3 is the next one up.
Yeah, I think I can tease maybe that, that you'll see more of Cooper than you might be expecting.
Oh, Thong.
A little singing.
No, I said thong. I didn't say song. I said thong.
That's a lot more Cooper.
Still wearing the suit coat and the tie, of course.
That's right.
But I'll settle for a song. Whatever.
That's right. I thought for a second you just had a lisp there, but you did not. That was not the case. But I will. You know, I'm happy to sing. I'm happy to sing at any time. I'm not happy to sing, but I'm happy to sing.
Got it.
There you go.
Noted. Yeah. Noted. Well played.
Thank you.
So a lot more of Cooper. Okay. So we're going to see a lot more of Cooper.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. For a little while. As far Excellent. As I can tell at this stage of our shooting. I for a time, and I usually say this, and I still say it, I have the best job on the show because I think, and I told this to Spader, line for line, I'm the highest paid actor on the show.
That's probably true.
I see what you're saying. That's funny.
I can't say about being pound for pound eyes because I'm probably the heaviest guy on the show, but line for line, yes.
Which is an interesting segue for the title of the next episode that's going to be out next week, which is 16 ounces.
Oh, yeah. I've completely forgotten what happened in it, but I'm guessing
there's some revenge factor since 16 ounces is a pound of flesh. That's probably where I'm going. Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. I honestly, unfortunately, but I think this is also true to life with the character. I forget episodes as soon as they're shot. Like, because I, you know, for me, they're exercises in memory and you're tied up in the story at the moment. But within the world of The Blacklist itself, things are happening all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Being able to retain them is difficult. It's a feat, but it makes watching the episodes very enjoyable. So this is the one show that I've been on ever. I've probably seen maybe 25% of the movies I've done,
mm-hmm.
Of the television shows before this one. I did watch Commander in Chief. That was only one year. But I've seen every episode.
Wow. This.
Yeah.
And you've tweeted through a lot of it. Yeah. I mean, yeah, you've been, yeah, which is great. Fans love that.
Fans love it.
Good. I enjoy it, the engagement, knowing in real time. It's almost, that's the one thing that this social media thing has done. People talk about, you know, the live feedback that you get from the theater, from a live theater show. And while they're not there generally when we're filming, you know, while it's airing, you get immediate feedback.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a lot of I think that's a silver lining in this new world we're in.
And I do want to add,
just so you know, some of my favorite scenes that are in the show are the ones where, and it's always you. It's always your character. You're the only character that ever really takes Red to task. And I always love when you and him, you and Spader are going at it, and it's a very stern scene. It's a, no, we're not doing that. You know, it's just you guys going back and forth with your power positions. Those are some of my favorite scenes in the show.
Yeah. I love it too. I love working with him. He's a masterful actor. Really, you know, a true superb craftsman, style, all of the stuff you're talking about. He's got that. And I always feel like, you know, it's sort of like Ali Frazier, you know, like, you know, it's, I'm a lot bigger, but you know, but he's crafty. He's, you know, he's got, so it's a lot of fun going toe to toe with him, a privilege. And I enjoy really working with all of the actors. We're our tight knitted group. Diego, you know, off screen, and I, you know, have a very good friendship, and, we have a lot in common, and, you know, sort of similar backgrounds, as different as they were, but he's working class kid from, grew up on a farm, whereas I grew up in the city. Mm-hmm. But a blue collar guy who, you know, loves sports and could talk about anything, much, much better read than just about everybody I know. Reads everything, knows a lot, very smart, but plays, you know, a kind of different guy, and kind of a jarhead guy on the show. Dedicated, but not perhaps, you know, on the, with the, he's not an academic, you know, in mm-hmm. that sense, but obviously a good cop and a smart cop. But anyway, he's, Megan, who I've come to really regard as a little sister in a lot of ways. We have a new gal on the show who I adore. I won't call her gal, a new actor on the show who I call Twinkle, cause she's a little star. Her name is Laura Stone.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, I miss Mojan and of course Parmender, but we, you know, we're a tight group and I like it. Taufik, Amir, you know, everybody.
That's great that you guys feel that way. I know sometimes I've talked to many actors. Some sets are not that way, as I'm sure you know, after being in it for 30 years.
Yeah.
And you and Spader have that in common. So you guys can bond over man. It ain't like it used to be.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, we do.
Well, you're a man of the craft, and before we let you go, we always talk about some kind of charity or thing that you're working on that the fans can get behind, and us being from the Chicago area, I'm not going to say we're in Chicago because that's disrespectful, but we're in the Chicago area, and I want to talk to you about this this African-American Museum of Performing Arts that you're doing there on the South Side. Like, where did the idea come from, and where is it, and what's it looking like, and how soon is it going to take off?
Well, thank you for giving me a little, you know, room to talk about it. It is, and we claim you, Troy, Chicagoland area, Chicago. So you're in Chicago.
Well, Aaron's in Rockford, so he doesn't count.
He wasn't counting me. He didn't even mention me at all. So he already counted me out.
They definitely count. I include you. You know, Michelle Williams from Destiny's Child is from Rockford.
Right? Yes, right? She is. Yeah, that's our big claim to fame here in Rockford.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's great. I know a couple of guys there, great actors and so forth. But that's Daniel Sullivan, for example. But
oh yeah,
yeah, great, great, wonderful man. The African American Museum for the Performing Arts is what I hope is going to be a living museum. So really, it's, you know, performing arts. I want to kind of be true to it, that you will be able to see an exhibit in the museum, but you'd be able to see that exhibit on stage, you know, in a performance venue. But in addition to that, we will archive the performances that go on there, and perhaps present performances from all over the globe, mostly the United States, because we're concerned really with what I call diasporic aesthetics, the art that derived from the African diaspora, which includes, of course, the transatlantic slave trade and so forth. But Black people in America created the only indigenous art forms outside of a duck decoy that the Native Americans made. But the original art forms are created by Black people, African Americans, if you will. But I prefer Black. but we are calling it the African American Museum, because I think that the diaspora, it goes beyond just the contiguous United States. So from Tierra de Fuego all the way up to Newfoundland or wherever, that is the diaspora as such. That is all America. And so we really want to create those forms. For example, I think if you think about Shakespeare, I would make the case, I'd have a difficult time proving it. I'm not a scholar. I don't, you know, in that way. But there was a time, perhaps in the early part of the 19th century, where Black Americans were the only Americans that were really notably doing Shakespeare on a stage. They had a theater company with its own building called the African Grove Theater down in the Village in New York that was burned, and the players therein were arrested while they were doing Richard III, and they were only released when they promised never to do Shakespeare again. But they were the rivals of all of the theaters that were, you know, this is pre-Broadway, but all the stuff that was out, the Astor Place Theater and other places, the Drury Lane, you know, not the Drury Lane, I believe that was in London. But that said, these people bravely, passionately were creating art against all odds. White actors would come and talk about it, you know, come and see them. They were famous, you know, and there's a performance history that you can track all the way back there and probably even before that. But you think about the dance, the literature, hermeneutics, the preaching styles, the musical, symphonic music and so forth, stuff that was being created that spoke, that inspired people like Dvorak to do the New World Symphony and all. Like, this is, these people were creating amazing art in the teeth of absolute hostility. And yet they are created this stuff, and it's the richer for it. And there's no place where actually people can go where it is a repository of that collective history. And so that's what the African American Museum for the Performing Arts is. We want to inspire, to train, to inculcate, to propagate, to preserve, perpetuate this magnificent form that everybody has derived benefit from, no matter what their color, no matter what their age. And there needs to be an institution that houses it and protects it. And so we also want, you know, the people to be able to get it online. You know, this is a new world where, you know, but we really want to be a center similar to the Lincoln Center for the Performing Arts, for this culture, for our culture. And I think that that's a big we. That's a big we. We want it to be for everybody, because I go back to the great Adam Clayton Powell Jr., who I had a chance to play on a Showtime movie called Keep the Faith, Baby. But, you know, he said something, which I believe, which is that Black is a state of mind. Hmm. You know what I mean? So listen, it's a big tent, but we want people to be able to have access and to learn about things that perhaps they did not know. I'm always learning something about these performers and the genre of work they have created all the time. And our first exhibit, by the way, will be a tribute to the man I consider to be the greatest practicing American actor in the stage, who's Anthony Chisholm, the great Anthony Chisholm, who I had the honor of being on Broadway with in August Wilson's last play, Radio Golf. And so we want to do really a living exhibit, you know, so people can walk in his path. Legendary man.
And that's amazing. So, yeah. Fantastic.
And it's a great location, too, on the south side.
Yeah.
That you picked out. Like, I'm excited to go down and check it out.
Great. You'll be the first to know.
We'll go. When's it open? Any idea?
Well, the museum is going to be housed at the Lillian Marcy Center. Mm-hmm. Lillian Marcy Performing Arts Center, and we are shooting for the fall of 2022. But AMPA will be in existence virtually before that time. So we're going to be doing a fundraiser pretty soon, and then we're going to start amassing, collecting, curating And so I'm thinking, you know, it's going to be a viable and living organization. And I hope by the fall. And so we'll be able to go online to the AMPA Museum, AAMPA MUSEME, mm-hmm. AMPA, AAMPA, and however you spell museum.org. And there'll be information that you'll be able to find on there.
So you're going to cover all different kinds of black art, like in terms, are you going to go through the years, Hattie McDaniel, Sidney Poitier? I mean, are you going to go through just everything in black culture?
Yes, black performance culture. You know Excellent. What I mean? When we think about, you know, the literature and things like that, certain kinds of music, perhaps it's not, well, I mean, that's a dedicated
performing arts, more performing arts.
Yeah. Yep. My friend Don Jackson, by the way, is trying to do a gospel museum down on the South Side and a church there. So, but yeah, we're going to be doing performing arts. So it will be music, obviously. It's going to be necessary. But but our focus is the performing arts, such as ballet, Muntu, you know, dance, like African inspired mm-hmm. dance or black dance, if you will. Plays, television, theater. I said plays and film. And as I say, I think spoken word, particularly the preaching styles, the spoken poetry, things like that. That's a pretty wide swath. And I think too, you know, not a whole lot, even in the new Smithsonian Museum in DC, there's very little comparatively. It's inadequate. Of course, that's kind of, you know, a superstore. It's kind of a target. But we're going to be a specialty shop. We're going to specialize in the performing arts history.
Well, I think it's fantastic, especially, I mean, Chicago has a large black population. I think that culture should be there, or that kind of museum should be there.
Yep. We agree.
I'm looking forward to the first performance of Harry and the Thong in the Key of C.
Harry Lennox singing.
To his own piano. Well, Harry, thanks so much for being here. We really appreciate it. The fans love you on the show, and we can't wait for the Blacklist to return next week, January 22nd, 8 Eastern and Pacific, 7 Central on NBC here in the States. Thanks so much, Harry, for being here. Always great talking to you.
You too. Thanks for having me.
You take care. All right, guys, I hope you guys really enjoyed that. I know it was a lengthier interview, but I think it was pretty fantastic. And we covered an entire body of the man's work. And I really do hope you enjoyed that. I had a great time.
Yes, it was an amazing experience. A few times we've met Harry now over the years. And I love the fact that he took the time to sit down and just share everything that's on his mind, in his body of work, and just letting us know a little bit more about where Cooper comes from in his backstory. I think that was a really great insight into, you know, the process, the acting, and just how he approaches all of his work and why he's so great. I mean, he literally is Director Cooper incarnate.
He really is. I'm telling you, once you meet him, same guy. Very, very, very similar. And I mean that with every compliment possible. So thank you for that. And what an artist. Look at that. He's talented. And he's got a musical that's going to come out soon.
Yeah, I'm excited. I'm excited to see that.
I still want him to sing. In a thong, maybe.
In a thong.
Hey, and I just want to mention before we move on that when Harry Lennox was talking about being in Justice League, the Snyder Cut, he was alluding to a character that he played, which is General Swanwick. That's who he played in Batman vs. Superman and in Man of Steel. And that character becomes, spoiler alert, Martian Manhunter. That's right. And if you really know your DC comic lore, he is more powerful than Superman. He's the last surviving Green Martian. He not only possesses many of the same abilities as Superman, such as he can fly, invulnerability, strength, heat vision, he also has the powers of telepathy, shape-shifting, and the ability to become intangible. Basically, he is bad as hell. And that would have been really cool to see come to fruition in later movies. But hey, at least we're going to get a peek at Harry Lennox becoming Martian Manhunter. I think that's fantastic. Emphasis on the fan, because it's cool for me.
All right, well, that's going to conclude this episode of The Blacklist Exposed. 7 seasons are on Netflix, and we are just getting started with season 8. So recommend The Blacklist to your friend, your enemy, your neighbor. And when you do, please also recommend they listen and subscribe to The Blacklist Exposed podcast. All the case files can be found at theblacklistexposed.com and everywhere great podcasts can be found.
For more great Aaron and Troy hijinks, follow us on your favorite social media outlet. I'm at Troy Heinrichs. He's at Aaron Smirks. And together we are at The Blacklist GSM. Don't forget, you can also check out Aaron on The Hollywood Outsider as well. So make sure you subscribe to that for all the great upcoming 2021 movie information and all the TV shows that we're going to be binging as the pandemic rages on. Thanks so much for just coming out this week and getting warmed up for the return of the show when we talk about 16 ounces next week.
That's 1 pound, by the way.
One pound of flesh. And Liz has come for that. All of it.
We don't know that. It could mean I got a steak. How much did it weigh? 1 pound. Maybe that's what it means.
Liz has got some steaks in this fight for sure as we continue.
Wow, that was a stretch, but I like the way you worked for it. All right, thanks for listening, everybody. Be sure to answer our profiling question. What team are you on? Team Fake Cat? Or team real cat? Hashtag fake cat, hashtag real cat.
We will cover off on all that and more that we've had during the hiatus. So make sure you stick around for the fan feedback next week. Thanks so much for being here, guys. We'll see you January 22nd.
Take care.
Until next time, I'm Agent Troy Heinrichs. That's at Troy Heinrichs on Twitter. And if you want to learn more about me, just visit, well, about.me/Troy Heinrichs.
And I'm Agent Aaron Peterson. You can hear me talking about movies and TV on the Hollywood Outsider podcast, as well as Remake This Movie Right. We are available at thehollywoodoutsider.com or on Twitter at 5popcorn. Be sure to subscribe, download the app, submit your feedback, but most importantly, keep yourself off of
the blacklist.
The Blacklist Exposed is a Golden Spiral Media production. Find more of our great podcasts at goldenspiralmedia.com/podcasts.
Do me a favor. Go find Diego and mess up his hair. Just do that for me.
Absolutely.
That's impossible.
All right.